Who's your trusted source when it comes to your facility questions, concerns, and needs? Ours is HardTrue, the world's largest manufacturer of tennis court surfaces, equipment, and accessories for over 90 years. Partner with their trusted team of experts, along with collegiate greats Jamie Loeb, Alex Rybakov, and Dustin Taylor, to bring the surface provider of over 30 professional events annually to your facility. Whether it's the red clay of the Houston ATP, the green clay courts of the Charleston WTA, or the official hard court of World Team Tennis, HardTrue has you covered. If you're looking to build a court, convert a hard court to clay, or simply resurface your hard court, work together with HardTrue in their mission to lead the tennis industry by creating better places to play. To learn more about their state-of-the-art surfaces, along with their catalog customizable on-court accessories, check out HardTrue.com or call 877-442-7878 today. That's HardTrue.com or 877-442-7878 today. The Mini Break, your daily podcast for the biggest storylines, results, and controversies from the tennis world. Today is Tuesday, February 23rd. There's been so much tennis that's gone on in both the professional tennis world, the college tennis world, even junior tennis is starting to pick up its schedule here in 2021. It's almost impossible to follow it all. And here at Cracked Rackets, I think we've done a pretty good job at covering all of the Australian Open. Hopefully all of you are caught up on how Novak Djokovic, Naomi Osaka emerged as the year's first Grand Slam singles champions. Hopefully, you're all well aware of what's happening in the college tennis world as well. It was such a blast for our Cracked Rackets team to be in person at both the men's and women's national indoor events. Of course, Chris Halioris, Matt Stachowiak, and I will be offering you all an update on what happened this past weekend in the college tennis world on tomorrow's Great Shot podcast. But something we haven't quite done yet that is one of my favorite things to do as a tennis fan is focus on the up-and-coming players, the players still grinding it out at the futures level, the challenger level. And last week, we had three phenomenal ATP challengers unfold. Joining me on today's podcast to break down all of the action, once again, you may know him as a writer on our website, crackedrackets.com. You may also know him as a writer for Last Word on Tennis. You know him on Twitter at All About Tennis Blog. I know him as my friend David Gertler. David, welcome back to the show. How are you holding up, my friend?
Thanks for having me. There's so much tennis going on right now. I don't even, it's like tennis overload.
It's overwhelming. It's incredible.
Especially because we just had a Grand Slam, and usually, you know, right after the Australian Open, it feels like a little bit of like a lull, but this year it's just like full steam ahead.
No, the craziest part, we have three ATP events this week. We have another WTA event, which of course was preceded last week by a simultaneous WTA event happening in Melbourne. There are always too many futures events going on in any given week to keep track of. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a pandemic season. All of these tournaments, when a date becomes open, if they think it's possible for them to host a tournament, they're going to hop on the date. And these tournaments, these events are going to come up sporadically. And as tennis fans, you know, I always joke around on this podcast, David, tennis really is a 24/7, 365-day a year sport. It legitimately was these past 2 weeks. You had challenger action starting, you know, early in the day in South Africa. You had, of course, the Australian Open matches and the WTA ATP events even before that in the earliest parts of the mornings. Then you had the European challengers starting. There's always an American stream or two to find as well. How are you feeling? I feel like sleep-wise, you must be a little bit deprived.
A little bit. I would say a little bit, but for me, it's like at a certain time, like I have, class and work. At a certain a certain time of the day, I gotta shut it down.
No, it's fair. For me, it's like, I mean, Yeah, this is the grind of February. The fact that the Australian Open was thrown into this month meant it was always going to be chaos. But again, that's been a really fun thing for us tennis fans, given last year we missed about 6 months of tennis. They are really trying to make it up here in the early portions of the season.
What do you mean we missed? We had the wonderful East Coast exhibition with total clean tennis. No fixing at all.
Yeah, the U.S. Pro Series, they just tried so hard. Yeah, it was just...
Karatsev, it was so funny, you know, thinking back to Karatsev in that exhibition, you know, losing to, who was it, like Jordy Arcanada, Adam El Midawi, or and people,
yeah.
Something like that. And now seeing him in the Grand Slam semifinals, it was interesting to think about.
No, good for him. I watched more Dusty Boyer this summer than anyone has any right to do. And it's just like, yeah, I agree with you. Speaking of which, you wrote a piece during the Australian Open on Aslan Karatsev, his run to the Australian Open semifinal. And I believe you wrote it after the second or maybe it was the third round. But, you know, I haven't had the chance to talk to you on the podcast. Yeah, and so I haven't had the chance to talk to you on the podcast since, but, you know, Karatsev was a guy when we recapped the Challenger season from last year and when we were talking about who were some of the best players, he was unequivocally maybe the best player on the Challenger Tour last season. I'm sure semifinals was unexpected for all of us, but watching his performance over the 2 weeks in Australia, what were your takeaways? Was it a noticeable jump in his level of play, or did everything he was doing last year just kind of translate in this one event?
Well, a lot of what he did last year was on clay. So I think it was, given what I saw in qualifying, it was not surprising that he made it to Schwartzman. It was surprising that when he beat Schwartzman, I was like, holy crap. Like, and not only beat Schwartzman, I think he only gave up like 9 games. That was like super impressive. And then you thought he was running out of gas against FAA. And then out of nowhere, he just turns that match on its head. And then he beat Grigor. You know, I hear a lot of the Grigor injury stuff. It's like, you know what? You went out there. You didn't retire. I don't want to hear the excuses.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny because I didn't have the chance to watch too much of the Australian Open live, just with all of the broadcasting we were doing and all the various things at Correct Rackets, but I did get the chance to lock in on Karatsev over the last few rounds when things kind of slowed down. And, you know, I had watched him play Challenger Tour matches, and it's so different on the clay, and it's so different at that level, but to see him just take... It feels like he does play a late 90s, early 2000s game, and it's not the firepower of Murat Safin, but the way he just takes every ball early, and his backswings are so efficient and so small. It's not these big cuts you see now from a guy like Francisco Cerundolo, who we're going to talk about in a little bit. But
who I was going to say was the other contender for Challenger Player of 2020, because he won 3 Challengers last year.
Yeah, he was incredible. And again, we're going to get to Cerundolo momentarily, but just to finish up on Karatsev, he does make the game look very easy. His contact point is so fluid. He can do a little bit of everything. And as you mentioned, what's so, I think, encouraging if you're a Karatsev fan, and we don't have to get into his background, we don't have to get about some of the shady things that happened in matches in the past. Is this a guy who always had the talent, and just for reasons outside of, you know, the integrity of the game, just wasn't doing his best on the court, whatever. We don't have to get into
that. We can get
right
into
now.
That with Gabashvili.
Or how about Nicholas Kicker getting a wild card into the Cordoba event this week? Or I don't know if it's Cordoba.
I don't blame the tournament. I blame the ATP and WTA for letting stuff like that happen. I think for the first year after a drug or gambling ban, you shouldn't be allowed any wild cards.
No, I agree. Maybe even it should be a lifetime ban from wild cards. Truly harsh in the penalty so that these players know, hey, if you do this, you are compromising the integrity of the game, and we're going to take that seriously. It's like, if you're going to try and confront the problem you actually have. I was talking about this with a player the other day who's going to remain nameless, and they were like, look, if you're trying to disincentivize match tanking, what you have to do is have harsher penalties, and you have to make an example of someone, not just in, you know, the 100 to 500 range or the sub 500 ranked players who
are
doing it perhaps a bit more blatantly. Yeah, but there are players who are in the top 100 now who have done it in the past.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a fact. And I just, Yeah, whatever. Again, this is a topic for another time. It really is Karatsev, good to talk with
one
you.
One more thing on Karatsev that I noticed was that on his forehand, I thought that the angles he generated from his forehand were super impressive. And I was like, he would like wind up and then he would hit these driving people way off the court. And I'd be like, how did he do that?
That's what I'm saying. I completely agree. It's that on the rise, but it's not the power of Safin. It's that late 90s, early 2000s on the rise tennis, but the success he's had on the clay, it's translated to the hard courts. You're absolutely right. The way he opens up the court for himself and moves forward and just takes advantage of time and space, it's a really well-rounded game.
And that win over Nakashima now, given how Nakashima is looking better and better.
Yeah, and isn't he the one who said his toughest match was first round qualifying or whatever against Nakashima? And it's just like, yeah, okay, that passes the eye test, that passes the smell test as well. That's pretty funny to hear. But no, I mean, again, Karatsev was fantastic. It's not, you know, he's in the top 50 now. Will he sustain a top 50 ranking? It's a fascinating question. Certainly. It's going to be really interesting to see what he does from a scheduling perspective, because I'm sure he had a bunch of challengers lined up ready to go, and now it's like, well, wait a second. I need to go play 250s. I can go play 500s. I can play pretty much whatever event I want.
Right.
Aslan Karatsev was one to watch heading into the year before his Australian Open run, and I think now it's going to be interesting because I'm sure a lot of eyeballs will continue to stay on him. But... and again, this is why it's so fantastic to have you back on the show today, David. There's a lot of stuff for us to talk about, given how much has unfolded at the challenger level. And look, I feel like we could probably talk about even the challengers that happened, because I think there were a few challengers that first week of the Australian Open, if memory serves me correct as well. But we're going to, you know, let those go by the wayside for those of you curious what's happened over the past 2 weeks in the challenger tour. There have been, let me see here, I want to be correct. I'm looking at the schedule. There have been 6 challengers over the past 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago, it was Benjamin Bonzi, Ilya Marchenko, and Ruben Bemelmans earning titles. This past week.
Get it one, huh? I was not.
No, it's there's always one. Yeah, exactly. There's always one. But of course, this past week we had 3 challengers, 1 in Italy, 1 in Chile, 1 in South Africa. I know the one you watched most is the one in Chile. I also had the chance to catch up on all of the highlights, all of the matches from there. So we're going to start in Concepcion on today's podcast where, you know, simply put, we had a fantastic all-Argentinian final in the end. It was Sebastian Baez winning his, I want to say, let me look here on his career, Sebastian Baez winning the first challenger title, I believe, of his career as he knocks off Francisco Cerundolo 6-3, 6-7, 7-6 to earn the title. Now for Baez on the week, he was unseeded. He knocked off number 2 seed Andre Martin in the semifinals. Yeah, who was playing
his match over the first set of his quarterfinal against Altmaier was one of the most physical sets I've seen in a long time.
No, I mean, again, he played some spectacular tennis for Baez. He also beat number 4 seed Hugo Delian in the quarterfinals and then knocks off the unseeded, but as you mentioned, one of the top challenger players in the world during the 2020 season, Francesco Cerundolo, 6-3, 6-7, 7-6. Let's start with the Sebastian Baez side of this equation. Baez, 20 years old, doesn't turn 21 until late in December. Currently number 312 in the world. That's, I believe, 4 off of his career high ranking of number 308. And when you look at Baez, yes, this was the first challenger victory of his career, but he's 20-8 in his last 52 weeks. During that course of time, that includes a final he made on the clay at a 25K in Prague back in September. It includes a couple of semifinals in the 2 subsequent 25Ks he played. He also made quarterfinals at a challenger late November last year, round of 16 at a challenger.
That when he lost to Galan?
That is when he lost, I believe, to Andre Martin in the quarterfinals. That was a match he lost 4-4. He lost to Galan in Campinas the next week in the round of 16.
In that match, he showed a lot of potential. He kind of choked it in the end, but that was a great learning experience when he lost to Galan.
Yeah. No, in fact, he ended up beating Daniel Gallant in the round of 16 this week. So he literally took out the 5 seed, the 4 seed, the 2 seed, and then Cerundolo 7-6 in the third. If you've watched Sebastian Baez play, the first thing that stands out, he's what, like 5'6", 5'7", generously. His movement, exceptional, and the way he moves the ball around the court. I think it was Paul Timmons who compared him to Diego Schwartz. Yeah, 5'7". Compared him to Schwartzman. It's an obvious comparison to make. They're both Argentinian, obviously. They're both not the biggest in stature, and they can both do a lot of things with their ground strokes. But, I mean, for me, the thing that stands out for Baez is just the way he moves the ball around the court, David. I mean, he plays such high-percentage tennis, and yet he is still being dynamic with his shot selection. Mm-hmm. It's a really well-rounded, really high-floor sort of game.
Yeah, the speed around the court, the anticipation that he has for opponent shots, that was something I noticed big time in that match with Gallant. He knew where Gallant was hitting the ball before Gallant knew where he was hitting the ball. Yeah, and then, you know, he surprised me, though, because at the beginning of the week, I was like, I don't know. Of course, it was a jinx. He had a great week. When he beat Martin, like I said before, that was when I really realized this guy was the real deal. He hit with great depth, with consistency, high consistency, which you mentioned, and he really impressed me. And he did it consistently. He until the final, he didn't lose a set. And playing Gallant, Delian, and Martin all on clay and to straight set them all and really not have much troubles at all in any of those matches, in any of the sets. He only had one set out of those three that went – out of those three matches that even went 7-5. It was super impressive. Now, the thing is, you know, can he sustain it, you know, over the course of many – challengers and really start to move up, that's to be seen.
Yeah, and for the record, with the victory, Baez moves up to number 256 in the live rankings. I think he was up as high as 254, has moved down a couple of spots in the days since. But yeah, you look at the totality of his performance this weekend. This past week, he dropped, as you mentioned, just one set. It was that 7-6 second set to Cerundolo in the final. You look at his service numbers throughout the week. He was over 64% in every single one of his matches, over 73%, excuse me, in four of the five matches. And yeah, it's just he plays high-percentage tennis. He puts a ton of returns in the court as well. And it is worth noting, as you mentioned, you know, how sustainable is Baez's performance outside of a clay court? In particular, you know, you can tell right away he plays 6, 7, 8 feet behind the baseline, uses his speed and that extra bit of time to track extra balls down. And if he gets his racket on the ball, more often than not, he's making really clean contact. He's swinging through that shot. But you know, I thought it was a really nice adjustment from Cerundolo in that second set to start employing more drop shots and to use his forehand not as linearly, but to start, you know, opening up the court and starting to play with more spin, more height over the net as well. And just kind of, you know, he also started to move forward a bit more and just take that time away from Baez. And you look at Sebastian Baez in his career, it's funny because he lists hard court as his favorite surface on his ITF profile. He's played 16 total matches on hard courts in his career. Now, he's only played 147 matches thus far, and he is only 20 years old, doesn't turn 21 till December. But that is the big question now, because with his ranking, he's going to have the option to not play exclusively clay court events. He will have the option to try.
He is 11-5 on hard courts.
Yeah, but that's such a small sample size, and it's like, where have those – I don't think he's played a single challenger yet on a hard court. I know he played Australian Open qualifying – or no, not Australian Open qualifying. Excuse me. I'm looking through his career. I mean, he played one hard court match in the post-pandemic season last year. It was a 25K match that he lost his first round 6-7, 6-0, 6-3 to Raul Brancaccio, who respectfully, I watch a lot of tennis. I have not seen the name Raul Brancaccio before.
He's a clay courter, actually, and he's nothing. I mean, good.
No, this I think he's yeah. I'm clicking on him now. He's top 400, so I'm sure I will see him more frequently in challenger draws. It's tough now, right? Because you have to be almost top 250 to get into a challenger, and it's like, with all due respect, I'm not scrolling through all seven ITF draws every week. So sometimes you're gonna miss a guy like that.
He used to be on the challenger tour more than he has been recently.
Yeah, again, and I'm sure we'll see him later in the year. Raul Brancaccio is not the subject of today's podcast, with all due respect to Raul. But in terms of Sebastian Baez, as I mentioned, he's right around that top 250 now. He's been really, really successful, 20-8 again over his last 52 weeks. You want to look in general in 2020. He was 28-13 overall. I will say, actually, you look at what he did on a hard court. So 15 Ks at Monastir. He made the semifinals in January, lost to Nuno Borges. He made and won a 15K on hard courts the next week, and then the subsequent week he lost in the quarterfinals to Lucas Catarina in straight sets. I don't know. If you're him, do you play some futures events on hard courts? Do you go now and look to play exclusively a challenger schedule? What's your next move if you're Sebastian Baez?
You know, that's a good question. What do I think he should do, or what do I think he will do?
You can answer it however you want, David. It's always open-ended here on the mini break.
You know, I think he has either qualifying or main draw at Buenos Aires, right? In a couple weeks. I think that he needs to play more challengers. If he can get that base on clay, then try to transfer it to hardcore. Which is kind of what Nakajima's been doing in reverse, where he's really been focusing a lot on hard courts, but he needs to now move to clay. I guess I want to see more on clay from Baez, and then eventually, once you get playing at that good level over time on clay, then you can start to think about hard courts. Because the last thing I think he should be doing now is to lose a bunch of hard court matches and totally stop his momentum that he has.
100%.
Because we're now starting to move towards the road to Roland Garros, and I'm assuming he'll probably by the time the cutoff happens, be in the qualifying draw. Hopefully, fingers crossed. I don't know exactly when the cutoff is for that, but if he keeps playing like this, he'll definitely.
No, and the thing is, if he's playing why I completely agree with you is the challenger level points he'll be getting if he's just playing clay challengers and winning even only his first round match are just significantly more than even winning a futures event on hard court or just any from a points perspective. Given he's got a top 275 ranking, I agree with you. Ride it, you know, when the mic is hot, ride it out. And for him, he's played exceptional on the clay courts of late. And again, he kind of just took away everything Cirandola wanted to do. Cirandola wanted to take big cuts at the forehand, but Baez was kind of like, all right, I know you're going to do that. I know you're going to try and open up the down the line by going heavy cross court. I'm going to beat you to the spot. I'm going to go down the line, and it's not going to overwhelm you with pace. But as you mentioned, he gets great depth on all of his shots, great placement, and just, you know, gets the point back to neutral. And it's such a physical battle against him. He is going to wear you down, put so much pressure on you. Now, on a hard court, you wonder, does a big serve, a big plus one forehand hit through the court a little bit easier? Does it become a little bit easier to, you know, beat him when he can't stand 12 feet back on the return of serve? And that's a question he'll have to answer if he wants to enter the top 100. But he deserved, I mean, he was the best player this week in Concepcion. That doesn't always happen, right? That the best player takes home the title.
Yeah, I mean, if you just, like I said before, if you look at Galan, Delian, Martin, Cirandola, like, if you're beating those four in a row, you totally deserve the title.
Yep, I agree with you there. Now, quickly, let's talk about Cirandola, who we've mentioned in the past, and for Francisco Cirandola, who makes the final here this week. He's now 32-8, David, in his last 52 weeks of play. You look at what that's involved for him, for Cirandola. Since just the restart last season, he won three challenger titles, all on the clay. He then makes another final here in February, I believe. He did play Australian Open qualifying and ended up losing to Villa Martinez, but I think that was a match he withdrew from. I was going to say he withdrew from that match, correct?
Yeah, I think he would have had a great chance to qualify if he didn't have COVID.
No, I agree with you. You look at the wins he got this week, a three-set win over Nicolas Jarry in the second round. We know Jarry is a top 100 guy when
Jarry
he's not.
Choked that badly, though. It was a...
Hey, it's a credit for Cirandolo for hold and serve with him the entire time, right? Making 68% or 67% of his first serves and only getting broken, I think, three times in the match. But, you know, yeah, anyways, that's a high-level win. He also knocked off Sabeth Vild in straight sets in a match that was a very... You know, Thiago Sabeth Vild seems to have finally found his legs again, and he's starting to play...
Cirandolo against the other...
Exactly. I want, you know, they're sharing notes, by the way. But no, I think he, you know, it's a really good win over Sabeth Vild to beat Alejandro Tabilo, who's played very well
The
past 6 months. Yeah, to beat him 1-1 and to make only 45% of your first serves in that match. I mean, that just speaks to how well and how confidently Cirandolo is striking the ball from the baseline. And even in the Baez match, I loved the adjustments he made. I loved the patience he displayed where, you know, that first set got away from him. He got the break back of Baez. I believe that was for 2-3 and then handed that break back pretty quickly. And there's a world where, you know, he thinks, all right, I made the final, whatever. It's just not my day today. I'm going to have to make a million balls and I don't really want to do that. So I'm going to quit on this match. He did not quit on the match under any circumstance. He had made the adjustments. He started moving forward. He started, again, playing more angle as opposed to trying to drive the ball through the court and just opening things up for himself. And yeah, the forehand's the calling card. It's a big backswing and it looks a little bit better on clay, but it's not like, it's not Soderling dramatic where I don't think, you know, I think it's a hitch or I think on a hard court he's not going to have time to do it. I look at Francisco Cirandolo, who, you know, turns, I want to say, 23 years old in August of this year, currently ranked number 146, I believe, in the live rankings. But you look for him, number 136 in the live ranking. That's one off his career high of 135. He's 22 years old. Perfectly positioned, right? It's really funny. I'm looking at the live rankings right now, David. Number 136, 22-year-old Francisco Cirandolo. Number 137, 22-year-old JJ Wolf. Like, and it's just very funny to think how different the pathways were for both of them to get where they are in the rankings now. But I think if you're Francisco Cirandolo, especially with the South American clay swing coming up, this is his moment to enter the top 100. He's playing that well, and he could do what, you know, I don't think, I guess it's not a direct comparison since Karatsev beat Schwartzman and FAA and Dimitrov to get to the semifinals of the Australian Open, but if I tell you Francisco Cirandolo is going to make the semifinals of one of these South American clay court swing tournaments, would that shock you at all? Like, it wouldn't me.
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't at all. I think that, Cirandolo, it's great that you know he's starting to incorporate that. You talked about the variety, because I think that was something that in the past has been lacking for me a little bit. What impresses me the most, and what I wrote about on Twitter the other day, is that the way he's able to change directions on his ground strokes, especially the forehand, and hit into such small targets with ease and smoothness. So what I'm thinking of especially is when he's in the center of the court and he hits an inside out forehand at an angle that, for a winner, at an angle that I did not even see was there, you know, during the rally. Yeah. I just am like, how impressive is that? And he just turned, end a rally like that, you know, so quickly with that inside out forehand from the center of the court. And it's just so impressive to watch him go to work. And yeah, he beat some great, you know, he beat Carbayas Baena last challenger final, Andre Martin, Pedro Souza, and those were the three challenger titles he won, you know, in the final over. And he's there to stay. And I think we're going to see that, like you said, during the Golden Swing.
Yeah, no, he's my new Pedro Martinez Portero. Last year, I was all in on the PMP bandwagon. I was like, I'm telling you, he's making the fourth round of the French Open. Unfortunately, Sebastian Corda had to ruin that for me. But if Cirandolo gets into the main draw of this French Open, he will be my sleeper pick for every match he plays. And I will say, not sleeper to, you know, win the event. Let's not get crazy. But, like, he will be my guy. If you see that unseeded player in the third round where you think to yourself, who's Francisco Cirandolo? Remember, we were talking about him. on today's podcast. And again, we've gone a little long here on Concepcion. This was the one that time zone wise was the easiest to watch. And so I am curious. You look at some of the other results in the event. We talked about Nicholas Jerry already, who lost second round to Cirandolo.
This was Daniel, a really well played event.
There were so many fantastic first round matches, like the Felipe Melagini Rodriguez Alves versus Hugo Delian match. Like, to have that be a first round, or, you know, some of the other, I think, second round matchups. Like, I really like the Emilio Gomez Thiago Sabathville second round, or Orlando Luz Sabathville first round, Tarante Galan first round. This was a loaded draw. And so, again, yeah, your final takeaways from the event.
I was happy to see Daniel Altmaier play better. I know he'd been struggling, but he really played some high-level tennis. Juan Manuel Cirandolo had a tough draw against him. I think, you know, he's done well in Cordoba qualifying. He's a name to watch out for. Francisco's brother, Hugo Delian, looked great until he played Baez. And then I am very worried about Galan. He just lost again in Cordoba to Kovalik yesterday, and then he lost in this event too. He's just spraying balls, and he really has not taken the momentum that he had from 2020. Like, he's basically done the opposite of what Karatsev's done with his 2020 momentum.
Yeah. Now, again, it's such a long season, and so I, especially this early in the year, given how broken the schedule has been, I'm trying to focus more on the positives than the negatives, because I think in particular there has been a strong translation from how players looked at the end of last season to how they looked at how they look at the start of this season. Think Sabalenka, think Osaka for the headlines. Obviously, Daniil Medvedev, Andrei Rublev seem to have carried it over. We just did, you know, 5 minutes on Francesco Cirandolo, who has carried it over as well. I agree with you that, you know, Galan hasn't looked his best thus far, but it's only 2 weeks, right? You got, it's all about the perspective.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, you know, I agree. Plenty of time. Nothing to get too concerned about. But,
well, the thing is, he doesn't have like an overwhelming trait. Like with the Cirandolo forehand, you're like, oh, that's going to work always. For Galan, it was just kind of, oh, he's making a lot of balls and he's just in a really good rhythm right now. And you always worry about a player like that. It's almost Mitchell Kruger-esque just on a clay court, where if Kruger's physically feeling well and the forehand's landing that week, you're like, oh, he looks really good. He's been really confident, but you still have some lingering concerns. You put Galan in that category, right?
Yeah, so what he was doing so great last year was he was hitting these huge serves, and he was hitting with such great controlled aggression deep in the court. And this year, he's just spraying a lot of unforced errors. I think I might write an article on him, so more on that to come.
All right, you know what? I hate to drink Dragoon. We'll go with the word Dragoon. These articles to Cracked Rackets, but I will be sad if that one's the last word on sports, last word on tennis, just so you know. Just throwing that out there. Anyways, this is what I do. This is why you want to work with me, folks. I provide public peer pressure on David right as he was expecting it. And I'm sure that's exactly what he's looking for from me. But anyways, apologies for that. With that in mind, though, again, any final thoughts on Concepcion?
No. You know what was a great under-the-radar match that we didn't say? It was Tabilo-Coria. Did you see that one?
I did not. Give me the two-minute rundown.
Tabilo, first off, was playing great variety this tournament. He hit with the lefty. He played a great lefty game against Coria. Coria was up 5-2 in the third, and I thought the match was done. And then Tabilo, somehow in front of his home fans, you know, because he's from Chile, came back and won it in the third set tiebreak. Lots of fun, lots of breaks, lots of great clay court tennis, and it was great to see Tabilo play well, because, you know, he started 2020 a little slow, so it was great to see him back on his home turf on the clay and do well.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
No, perhaps the most remarkable moment for me was, you know, if you go watch the highlight video on YouTube, like I think it's at the beginning of the second set, where in Concepcion people rushed the court in that Shenandoah Baez match, and there was some sort of, I don't know if it was a protest, I don't know what it was, but it was something. It was absolutely something. And so, yeah, Concepcion providing the fireworks and certainly some spectacular tennis. Let's move on, though, to our next challenger. And I promise, folks, we're not going to do 15 minutes on all of these or 20 minutes on all of these. That one in particular was fun.
We could talk about this all day.
Yeah. Well, first of all, when I say we're not going to, I would do it. I know David would as well. I just know he, as he mentioned at the top, has, you know, things like school to get to. And so, you know, don't want to be too rude to him. But let's move now to Italy, where we had the Biela Challenger, working pronunciation. I apologize, folks, but we did have some fantastic results up and down the board. In particular, we had a final between two guys, borderline both next-gen players. Sun Wukong, a little bit aged out of that category, but Kwan looking exceptional here this week, the number three seed, I think dropping only one set throughout the course of the event as he knocks off in the quarterfinals Yannick Maiden, in the semifinals Evgeny Donskoy, and then in the final Lorenzo Musetti, the talented young Italian, 6-2, 6-3.
Yeah.
Let's start with the Sun Wukong. I was going to say, let's start with the Sun Wukong side, David.
Okay.
Your thoughts on his performance this week? I mean, this is a guy who entered the week with a top 100 ranking. He's a guy who has been ranked, I believe, as high as number 62, I think, or maybe it's, 69, excuse me, in the ATP rankings. With this result, he jumps back up to number 81. I mean, this is not his first challenger title, right? You look in his career for Kwan, this is challenger title number 3 for him, first since 2019, but that's because he spent all of 2020 playing ATP-level mm-hmm. events. It was really good to see him dip back down to the challenger level to try and, you know, find his form, find his level, and to see him have this sort of success. It just kind of reaffirms that sometimes you're going to struggle as you try to break through at the top of the ATP rankings, but Kwan definitely has the goods. He's another guy where it's just, especially on an indoor hard court, he does a little bit of everything, and everything he does well.
Yeah, he was able to control the baseline so well. And yeah,
100%.
You're right. He lost three of his first four matches of 2020. I watched the match, his opening match against Korda. He lost 6-4, 6-4. It was a lot closer than the scoreline indicated. But yeah, he made the smart decision, I think, after a pretty brutal loss to Kokkinakis in the Australian Open first round, to drop down to a challenger. And it worked out because he got his form and his confidence back. He played very confidently against Musetti. He knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he pretty much dominated the match.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the lowest number for him on the week of first serve points won. He won only 73.7, I say only 73.7% of his first serve points against Yannick Maiden, but he also won 76% of his second serve points. He was over 50% on his second serve in each and every one of his matches this week. He was over 74% in each and every one of his matches on the first serve conversion percentage. Now, that first serve percentage still leaves a lot to be desired, and I think for him, and that's why he continues to struggle a little bit in ATP Tour matches. And look, you look for Sun Wukong, you look at his record, you go back to 2019. He won, I believe, and I don't want to get this wrong here, back in 2019 for Sun Wukong, made a ton of finals. He had a ton of, 2019, he made final in Yokohama. He ended up winning that over Oscar Ota. Mm-hmm. 2 months later, makes the final in Seoul, ends up winning that over Max Purcell. And from there, you know, he started to play more ATP level events. And I think when you look at his 2020 season, he went 11-10 overall, only played one challenger. But, you know, you look at some of the losses. He lost to Nadal, he lost to Opelka, he lost to Kyle Edmund. He also lost to guys like Matteo Viola and Igor Gerasimov and Nicolas Bastilashvili in a 5-set first-round match at last year's Australian Open. And I think for him, the issue is there's, you know, it's not the overwhelming pace, the overwhelming pop. He does a lot of things really well, and he moves the ball really well around the court. But if you do have that big weapon to hit him off of his spot, that's when he can start to struggle. However, in this final match he played against Lorenzo Musetti here to win this challenger title. I thought Kwon did such a good job of targeting the Musetti forehand during baseline rallies, because that's the side for Musetti where, you know, it's a little bit of a hitch. It's a big backswing, and if you can attack that wing with pace, he'll leave you a short ball. And then once Kwon got that short ball, it was taking it early down the line or going short angle cross court, and just, you know, he did such a good job of targeting that side, and also did a good job of, you know, continuing to hit the Musetti backhand, but with the purpose of opening the court so he could attack the forehand wing. It was just a really well executed game plan. And, you know, again, for Sun Wukwan, I think they traded breaks early in set number one, but after that, he didn't look in trouble at any portion of that final.
Yeah, he went down a break early on.
Yeah.
He came back. Yeah, you know, do we want to jump to Musetti? Because I think this match told me more
Please.
About Musetti than it did about Kwon. So I'm not going to call that Musetti's run to the final a fraud, but I'm going to say definitely not as impressive. It was, you know, Gulbis in the quarterfinals self-destructed. Seppi ran out of steam. He's older. Seppi should have won that match. Napolitano's in a huge slump. That's who he put in the first round. In the second round, put Lacko, who besides a good week in Kemper, is over the hill. Here's the deal with Musetti. On a hard court, he still puts a little too much emphasis on topspin on the forehand. I think that the backhand variety is good enough, but it's not going to hurt the top players on hard. The ball sits up too much on hard for that forehand. And I think that the biggest problem with Musetti on hard court is that he tries to play clay court tennis on an indoor hard court, which didn't work against a good informed player like Kwon.
Oh, this is why I like having you on the pod. You just called Lorenzo Musetti's performance a fraud. That's delightful. That's the clip, by the way. Westhoff, save that. Yeah, I agree with you to an extent. So I agree with everything you say about the forehand. The forehand, he works it like it's a clay court. He tries to hit the short angle and these little soft, high looping balls that just respectfully sit up on a hard court, and Kwon beat him to the spot, took that ball early, and took control of the point. I 100% agree with you. And where I disagree, and, you know, the backhand, he gets a little slice happy. He'll go for these stupid drop shots where you're just like, what are you doing here? Like, you understand this, again, isn't a clay court. It's significantly easier for Sun Wukwan to change direction when he's playing on concrete and track that ball down. And where I disagree is the backhand. I think the backhand looks phenomenal on hard courts, on clay courts, on any court. I just think the way he makes contact, particularly on the return of serve, his backhand return of serve is his better side. Mm-hmm. And you don't say that often for someone with a one-handed backhand. And I think that's
beautiful.
It's a huge positive for him moving forward. I think the way he moves forward on a hard court is also a trait that, if he can be more efficient with, will be a huge positive for him moving forward in his career. And yeah, his serve's going to translate regardless of surface. For me, it's the forehand. It's just on a quicker surface, that forehand will have problems right now.
It's a long windup, right?
And yeah,
he really tries to get under the ball too much, I think.
Uh-huh. And he yanks out of it, too. Like, he's always falling back. And again, very easy for us to sit here and criticize his form when he would beat us 0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0. But these are the things you notice. Like, it again, versus a Sebastian Baez, where everything's out in front and everything is so steady, you can tell on a fast court for Musetti, it does disrupt his rhythm because, as you mentioned, that forehand's big. Yeah, you're not wrong. I mean, but still, I just think
– yeah.
I don't know. I agree with I don't think it was a flukish run, because I think physically, again, some of the traits you see from Musetti, the physicality, the serve, the aggression, the creativity, those things are all going to translate regardless of surface. It's legitimately just a forehand question. And the problem at the highest levels of pro tennis is if you have a glaring weakness, and it's the way with Francis Tiafoe. You know, every good player is going to be hitting big serves to the Tiafoe forehand because he just can't hit through that ball. Musetti's going to have that phase as he transitions to the highest levels of the game, and how he responds to that will define his upside as a pro player.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. He's going to have to get it figured out because Kwon was, like, I think, a good reality check in terms of you're not an ATP event, you know, because he can get up, you know, with his clay court game, he's going to be able to, I think, rise up the rankings some and maybe get into some like more ATP level events, like hard court events, potentially because of his clay court craft. So he's going to, but I think he's going to see a lot of results like Kwon if he tries to play ATP Tour hard court events. Because, yeah, I mean, I don't think that he got fortunate with a weaker draw, but he still had to win the matches. And it's great when, you know, and more practice on hard court, the better, I think. And, you know, he got a tough first round Australian. I don't want to take too much into his first round of qualifying loss to Van de Zanschulp, given how he played. And he did do, he beat Petrovic in Istanbul on hard courts, who has a good serve. So, you know, I think that I don't want to be too negative here because I really do like Musetti and I like his game. We'll see what happens.
No, it's, again, it's been a really high level of play for Sunwoo Kwon to take it to Lorenzo Musetti the way that he did. But yeah, it's a concern. I mean, if you have the big weapon on a hard court, it will be fascinating to see how Musetti responds. But again, if you're Lorenzo Musetti, who now makes his first final on hard courts at a challenger, it's his third challenger final in the past, 5 months? Obviously, for the now 18-year-old, still hasn't even turned 19, does so at the beginning of March, to be 122 in the world, he's exactly where he wants to be. This is all to say we are the reason we express this concern is because Lorenzo Musetti, as we expressed in our Next Gen podcast, is a guy who's got, you know, phenomenal upside, is a guy who can become a top 20, top 15 player if things break right for him. And so, you know, the forehand is one of those things that are going to have to break right for him. On this occasion, it did not. Sunwoo Kwon ending up in the winner's circle. Now, you look at some of the other results here. Andre Seppi, who you referred to Musetti beating, was the number 4 seed, so he essentially held seed. But our number 3 seed was Sunwoo Kwon. He won the title. However, our top 2 seeds both upset early in the event. Alejandro Davidovich Fokina, second round loss to Federico Gaio, 7-6-6-4. Yeah, completely surprising. And then Sebastian Korda, who has since beat Joe Wilfred Tsonga, obviously, this week at an ATP-level event, so I don't think we're too concerned about him, but he did lose a match to Dmitry Popko in straight sets in the first round. By the way, shout-out to our guy Raul Brancaccio, who I see here in the first round as a qualifier, losing to Ernest Gulbis 4-6-6-3-6-4, so I guess Brancaccio on the rise here, folks. But your thoughts on the rest of these Bila results?
Yeah, I mean, well, to be fair, Tsonga's coming off the big injury, so I kind of expected Korda to win that match.
No, me too.
But great, again, great to win an ATP level. It's winning ATP level matches can only help. Seppi beat Marchenko. Marchenko did a great job just to even get to the quarterfinals after a long week the week before, and he beat Madger Zach. Sorry if I mispronounced that. And he really fought hard, and it's great to see him playing well again. Donskoy had a good week. I think he sometimes gets a little underrated at times. People forget how good he can be. He played great, aggressive, hardcore tennis. So that was good to see. Golden finally put together a quarterfinal run.
Yeah, no, I again, you look at the draw. Evgeny Donskoy continues to play well. Andrea Seppi, I don't know if he's got, I think he's certainly more a challenger guy than he is a high-level ATP Tour guy at this point. He's a perfect litmus test for all of these young up-and-comers. If you can't beat Andrea Seppi, your game's just not ready physically for the ATP Tour. But no, overall, yeah, you know, guys like Marchenko, Donskoy, Yannick Maiden continue to play well. And I think more than anything else that you see guys like Kwon and Musetti and Cirandolo and Baez emerging from these challengers, it continues a trend we're seeing. These next-gen guys are coming. It's happening week in, week out at the challenger level. I think Bela was another example of that trend continuing. Of course, that trend continued in our final challenger event I want to talk about here as well. And I really just want to lock in on the performance of one player in particular because, you know, all of us now as American men's tennis fans, if you are American men's tennis fan, and I know I am, I know David is as well, we're all in on the Korda Nakashima bandwagons, right? We know Sebastian Korda now inside the top 100, made that Delray Beach final, fourth round of the Roland Garros last year. We know he's legit. We've all, you know, last summer was the summer of Nakashima. Everyone professed their love for him, his upside, et cetera, et cetera. So we know, you know, I think we all feel pretty confident that Brandon is going to be a star moving forward. But the player we have all forgotten about because he went and spent a year at Baylor and he suffered a bunch of injuries at Baylor, so he didn't get to play many matches. And yeah, it was this lingering turf toe. And then, you know, of course, we had the pandemic. And so was he really going to be able to play many pro matches? No, although he was able to play a bit of UTR, some UTR events and have some success. But the guy who uses his protected ranking to get into this draw in South Africa ends up running his way through to the final where he comes back and knocks off Gabashvili 2-6, 6-3, 6-love, earns his first challenger title and with it a spot back in the top 200, top 250 of the ATP rankings is Jensen Brooksby, the 20-year-old American earning the title here this week. He gets wins over Chem Ikkel in the quarterfinals. He knocks off Lucas
the previous week.
And then he knocks off Lucas Miedler in the semifinals in straights, finally comes back to knock off Gabashvili. Brooksby is a fascinating prospect to me for a bunch of reasons. I want to hear your thoughts on him first.
Before we get to Brooksby, I want to say, Gabashvili, we know what happened in that first round. When you lost 2-6 to Alec Beckley, that was the height. That was the peak of suspicious sex. So we know what went on there. So seems like a guy on Mike and Noah's podcast, but that was not good.
Yeah, no, it was a bold move. It was a bold move, certainly. But no, again. So that aside, Jensen Brooksby.
Yeah,
when you look at his game. It does. It's not as pretty as a Cirandolo or even, you know, the Nakashima. You can just see it's a ruthless efficiency. He's just going to go cross court, down the line. And just, again, the depth, the pace, all of the things he does. It's so he makes it look routine out there. For Sebastian Korda, the guy just oozes talent in everything he does. For Jensen Brooksby, you know, make sure your volume's not too loud when you're watching the highlights because he will make some noise during a match on the court. But for me, it's just the way he competes, man. I mean, it's a non-quantifiable category, but it reminds me of Stefan Kozlov and just like the way he'll make that extra ball. There'll be slightly better depth, slightly better pace than you expect, or you know, he's going to hit that two-handed backhand drop shot, which is. It's not pretty, but it
His
certainly works.
We're good. We're very good.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the other crazy part is like, well, he doesn't blow you away with his foot speed, and yet his anticipation is really, really good. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I don't know. When you see Brooksby, what are the things that jump out to you?
So, yeah, so the first time I really realized, like, this guy's going to be good was in the 2019 U.S. Open when he beat Yukita Tsuhita and then Pedro Martinez to qualify, then beat Tomas Berdych in the first round. That was when he kind of burst onto the stage, and then he got the toe stuff and the pandemic and all that. I like he has a good heavy first serve. The forehand is heavy. I noticed a lot of good aggression on the backhand side. Good depth on his shots, like we mentioned, defensive skills. He's only 6'2", but I think he plays as if he's a little taller. And it's no surprise that his favorite surface is on hard courts. And he's only 20 years old. I was really impressed with him this week. I expected him to lose to Ilkel. I think I tweeted at you. I predicted Ilkel to win. He beat Benjamin Bonzi, who had the previous week's winner in the second round, which is a really good win. Bonzi just had a nice win today in Montpellier. So Bonzi's an ascending player. So for Brooksby to beat him was great. He was down a set in the first round to Ryan Peniston. And he really, after that, didn't look back. Great wins this week. And really great to see after such a after the long injury layoff.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think for Brooksby, again, it's a little handsy. Like, it's very much he's flipping his hands on the backhand, and it's not as fluid through the shoulder. And on the, you know, it's very wrist-centric on the forehand as well. And yet, I mean, it just works. It really does just work. You mentioned the defensive skills. When he's on the run, when he makes contact with that ball, it's just going to be better depth than you think. And he does a really good job when he's in the center of the court of moving the ball around the court. If you give Jensen Brooksby time, now you're playing his game. Now you're in his pattern where he's just going to go cross, cross, line. And again, he's very, very good when he can be in the center of the court. Now, I don't think he's an exceptional mover yet. I do think he's still, you know, he doesn't have that explosive first step. Now, he's not a bad mover, but, you know, it's almost – it's Nakashima-y, right, where it's good, it's not great. And I probably even like Brandon's a hair more, and yet, you know, for Brooksby, he's like 6'2", 6'3". I like his size. I really do like the way the ball explodes off his strings. I think he hits a heavy topspin baseball off of both wings. And, I mean, you know – he's still working his way back from injury, still trying to get match tough. And I do think that movement, you know, if movement is a thing you're concerned about with someone, that's a good thing because you can always become a better mover. That is one of those tangible things. I mean, you know, I don't think. And so I just, I think he does a lot of things well. And he's still only 20 years old, so I'm a fan.
That's why I was so, you know, because he's not that great of a mover. So when I watch, when I'm watching him and I see the great, you know, defensive plays, it's a little surprising because you're right. He does he's able to produce on defense at a level that is not expected given his movement, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It definitely does. I agree. His defensive skills outweigh his, or outsize his athleticism.
I think it was a good I definitely, you know, now I, obviously in hindsight, it was a good idea to go pro as opposed to returning to Baylor.
I agree that I think it's fair.
He was gonna, you know, that U.S. Open, damn, was that impressive. And, you know, I thought from there, you know, he was gonna be the next, you know, what we see, you know, from Korda Nakashima, you know, recently. And so I'm really, then, you know, the injuries. But he really was, you know, it's easy to forget how good he looked. You know, against Pedro Martinez and against Burdick. And he gave back Lasvili a fight in the second round, too.
No, I completely agree with you. It's strange. That's what I really like about the contrast in these three players is for Sebastian Korda, again, it makes sense. Just the way his size, his athleticism, how natural it all looks, it makes sense. For Nakashima, it makes sense just because, again, the discipline, how good he is at just breaking down his opponents. And then Brooksby's kind of the wild card of the group. It's very, very intriguing. It's a little bit different than some of the others. So very excited, again, to see him healthy and to see him have this sort of success. And, you know, when you look at the rest of this South African challenger draw, and we can do that quickly, I thought it was a really good win for Kalawon Monsi, who, of course, is the younger brother of Illinois Sifo Monsi. And, you know, again, the Monsi brothers, so talented. He gets a win over Braden Schnurr in the first round. I think you look for Brooksby. It wasn't just in the final. He also got a really good win over an informed Benjamin Bonzi in three sets in the second round as well. Your thoughts on the rest of the results we saw here in South Africa?
Yeah, the draw was, I think, probably a little weaker than the other two. I want to say, I feel bad for Menendez, Macieras, and Miedler in that doubles match. I don't know if you saw that on Twitter at all.
I did not.
It was 10-9, they were down, and Nicholas Kuhn hits a double fault, clearly out, that the umpire was blocked and the linesman didn't see. So they lost on a missed call, which I felt bad for them.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. I did see that. That was something else.
Yeah. I love speaking of Menendez Messiera, seeing him make another quarterfinal. I'm one of the few people who like him. I love how he competes. I love how much he cares. So it's always nice to see him in a challenger quarterfinal. And that's That's what I got. Santillan is starting to play better. Nicholas Kuhn, man, he burst onto the scenes not too long ago, and he's kind of fallen off the wayside with all the injury issues.
I have always been a fan of his game. I've always been a fan of his talent. He can't put it together in matches. Like, you watch him, and there'll be these 3-minute stretches where you go, ooh, who's that young? You know, who's that youngster? Give me more of that. I believe he was an IMG kid when he was younger. I may be wrong about that, but he was someone who 15, 16 years old was starting to put together some really impressive futures results, and it just hasn't translated yet. It really hasn't. I agree with you. I have been surprised to see him not make a big jump, but, you know, again, three really fun challengers this past week. Tennis throughout the day, 24/7 for anyone who missed out on any of the action in Australia. Unfortunately for us, while we do have the three ATP events, while we do have the WTA event, we also have two challengers this week. David, this is where I want to end today's podcast. You look at the two events. We've got one going on in Nur Sultan, where we've already had a couple of fun results. Mackie McDonald knocking off Mikhail Kukushkin, the number one seed. Yeah, that's a first-round match. That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy. And our guy, Yuri Rodionov, finally putting a victory on the board. He knocks off a lucky loser in Ivan Nedelko, but still, he gets a victory. Your other seeds here on the weekend, you've got number 8 seed Blaz Rola, number 5 seed Henry Laxinen, the 7 seed Martin Kleesen, 4 seed Pranesh Gunaswaran, the 2 seed Evgeny Donskoy. I believe the number 3 seed from this event ended up withdrawing. That's why we don't see him. But there's your Nur Sultan update.
Yeah, Blanche get a win over Popko. I like Blanche. I think he has a lot of potential.
I was ready to declare Ulysses Blanche my favorite young American after his run through Ann Arbor last season. I think I've told you that before, but I'm a big believer in his as well. That's challenger number 1. Challenger number 2, clay event going on in Spain. Your top seed, Lorenzo Musetti. 2 seed, Carlos Taberner. Your number 3 seed, Federico Gayo. 4 seed, Nikola Milojevic. And then a bunch of fantastic players littered throughout the draw as well. You mentioned it. Nicola Kuhn, first round loss again for him this week against Ricardo Bonadio. But more broadly, your thoughts on the challenger matches we're going to see this week, David? Things to watch for our listeners.
Yeah, so Maroney is a player that when he's on, when his backhand's able to hold up, he's one of the most fun clay court players to watch. Really heavy forehand. Great angles, great variety in his game, and he looked great in the first round against Guinard. So he's a player to watch. Musetti has the one seed. He has a tough draw after the first round. You know, he's going to play Mulkin, who some days Alex Mulkin looks like he can see top 100. Sometimes he looks like he's top 1,000. So if Mulkin is on, that's going to be a tough match. Then he has to play either Horansky or Maroney. So Kuhn lost yesterday, which is another day. You know, he doesn't put enough margin on the balls, and that was so apparent against Bonadio, you know, who has these beautiful, heavy, you know, high margin ground strokes. Giannessi is another player who's been under the radar, playing pretty good clay court tennis. Have you noticed that with Giannessi?
It's so tough because I do feel like we get a different Italian player making a run every week, and they can all do so many different things. You know, it's so interesting to see this generation of Italian tennis players, whether it's Napolitano or Giannessi, or obviously Sonego's had a bunch of success of late as well. But, you know, for Giannessi, it's tough, right? Because there are some matches where you see him just connecting with the ball from the baseline, and you're like, whoa, what's this? You're like, I am intrigued. Like, I am very intrigued by the way you move the ball around the court. And then there are times when he'll make these, you know, he'll miss, it feels like, 30 shots out of 35 attempts. And you're just like, what are you doing?
Yeah, the backhand can sometimes look.
Yeah, especially the backhand.
And then the last thing I want to say is about this one is the good for Marco Tringoliti winning that really tough match against Manuel Valero yesterday.
Yeah, I'm still trying to play catch up from last week, so I have that in my queue of matches. But more than anything else, I just feel like there are again, I think you're just seeing, and it's different this week because there are three ATP events being offered, but all of these players are looking for competitive opportunities, and so we've seen a really high level of play at the challenger level.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah, no, and so again, it should be a really fun time for tennis fans, another great week of action, and if you have missed out on any of the action, you can catch up on all of it by checking out our website, crackedrackets.com. Of course, if you need the more immediate updates, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, we are at Cracked Rackets. You want to message me, I am at Great Shot Pod. Shout out, as always, to our super producers, Max Fleeger and Daniel Westhoff, for the of an editing job they do day in, day out. Shout out as well to our friends at Midwest Sports. Go to MidwestSports.com. Use that promo code CR15 to get 15% off your order. Free two-day shipping on all orders exceeding $75. Best of all, a free can of Wilson Extra Duty Tennis Balls. MidwestSports.com. The promo code is CR15. With that in mind, David, any final thoughts on the past couple of weeks of Challenger play, and more importantly, any preview for our listeners on what you're going to be up to, and, you know, of course, where they can follow all of your work?
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, that Golan piece, maybe we can do February All-Stars, maybe. And then we maybe, you know, you mentioned before something on the Sprunderlo brothers, so we can talk about that. Yeah, so I am I write for Last Word on Tennis. I have my own blog, All About Tennis blog, and then I right for Crack Rackets. You can find me at TennisBlogger1. And I'm always, you know, you're welcome to, you know, tweet me whenever, because I always love, as you can tell from this podcast, I love talking about Challenger tennis. And so feel free to tweet me.
No, absolutely. Again, it is always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. When you... You don't have to thank me, David. Thank you for putting up with my nonsense. I was going to say, when you write your February, because we never did the January All-Stars for a podcast, which we should have. It's just a little bit too far in the rearview mirror now. But when you write your February All-Stars, at a minimum, that will be the next time we have you. Hopefully, we'll get you back on before. But again, hope you are staying safe and healthy, and we appreciate your continued work, all you do to shine a light on all levels of the tennis world. With that in mind, for my wonderful co-host, David Gertler, our super producers, Fleegner and Westhoff, our friends at Midwest Sports, and all of us here at both Cracked Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I am your host, Alex Gruskin. David, this is always the ultimate test. Do you know what we tell our listeners?
Yes, I do. Should I say it?
Absolutely.
That's the break.
I love it. Perfect. And we will see you all next time. Thank you, as always, David.
Bye. Thanks.